for this portion of the program. We have two representatives of the Obama administration to talk about disability rights. The way we have been doing it during the course of the deliberations so far is that those who are making presentations are offered 15 minutes apiece, and then we get to questions. I know that the two of you haven't been in previous sessions, and consequently, I wasn't aware of whether you had been given the marching orders. And I don't know whether the marching orders apply to you anyway, but those are the ones that we've used so far. The first person to make a presentation this morning was nominated by the president to be the third assistant secretary for disability employment policy and was confirmed by the Senate on June 25, 2009. Prior to her appointment to the Office of Disability Employment Policy, she served as executive director of the World Institute on Disability, where she directed Provecto Vision, the World Institute's National Technical Assistance Center, to increase employment opportunities for Latinos with disabilities in the United States, and access to assets, an asset building project to help reduce poverty among people with disabilities. Please welcome Assistant Secretary of Labor, Kathy Martinez.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark, or sorry, Dr. Maurer, I forget the formality here. And thank you all. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I will make my speech 15 minutes, but I'm going to ask Dr. Maurer if he would kindly give me a nudge, just not too hard, or there's an edge right over here that I'd prefer to stay on the stage. But give me maybe a two-minute. Do you have a watch?
Oh,
he does. Uh-oh. Okay. Anyway, it's a pleasure. And I know we're talking about the intersection of civil and human rights and disability rights. So I just want to give you all a brief history about myself, because this is the first time I've been here, and I haven't spent too much time with the National Federation of the Blind. But I'm very well aware of the impact and influence you've all had in my life, fighting for the rights of folks with visual impairments and folks that are blind, like myself. I was born blind. I grew up in a very large Latino family, and even though my parents were both U.S. citizens, I have vivid memories of the immigration pounding on... sorry about those P's, folks. That's really annoying. It is. On our door, demanding that my parents produce their birth certificates. And I remember when we would go to meetings at my school and the administrators would speak louder and louder to my mother because her English wasn't so great at the time. We lived very close to strawberry fields when I was growing up in orange groves in Southern California. And at an early age, I became very aware of the farm workers who worked in those fields. And my brothers and sisters and I would walk past the fields to go to a playground. It was in the days when your mom would kick you out and tell you to be back before the streetlights went on. It was a different world then. But we would pass these fields, and I was very taken because I would always hear people disputing what I learned later was disputing how many strawberries they picked when they were paid at the end of the day. I had a student teacher in eighth grade who read to me on tape the book called Sweatshops in the Sun, which really profoundly influenced my awareness of the working conditions in those very fields just a couple of blocks from my house. And I began to be involved in the youth effort to improve conditions for local farm workers. Unfortunately, while I was connecting with folks around my, quote, Latinaness, they had no clue how to handle the blindness factor. And I did, however, get a lot of information about unions and kind of, you know, the early days, or I guess it was the it wasn't so early, of you know, farm workers, and I got a lot of information about that. They didn't really know what to do with a blind kid. During that period, which was in the mid-70s, you know, political activism was raging, and I met some women who were very active in the women's movement. And I thought, okay, I'm a woman, I'll be welcome there. And again, although I was well-liked, I was not well-utilized, and in the efforts to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, you know, I was kind of, again, I learned a lot about women's oppression and activism and strategies used for organizing and you know, to and political strategy. But I, again, I was not well utilized. And I was telling Dr. Maurer earlier that in 1977, I happened to be at the Orientation Center for the Blind in Albany, California, and we got a Braille notice saying that there was going to be this sit-in in at the San Francisco Federal Building. And one of the first people I met there was Muzzy Marcelino, and this is, I know this is really dating me, but I was just so blown away with Muzzy. He was a member of the Federation. He was just such a great leader and such a super activist. And the thing that he pointed out to me there was that there were so many people supporting this effort. And that's when I realized that disability rights is a car on the train of civil rights. We are. You know, we learned a lot from our African-American brothers and sisters. We learned a lot from the gay and lesbian movement, from the women's rights movement, about how to organize. And really, I think we could do a lot more to increase our collaboration with those communities, especially because folks, the disability, incidence of disability is higher among the African-American and Latino community. And in terms of blindness, you know, there's a lot of diabetes, the incidence of diabetes is much higher than it ever has been. And the incidence of blindness, from what I understand, is starting to increase. So I met Muzzy, and it was just amazing to see how he connected the dots in terms of using folks from Glide Memorial Church, using folks from the Farm Workers Union, using folks from all different, from the women's movement to, you know, to help bolster our cause. And he was just an amazing catalyst in that time around getting the 504 regs implemented. So during that time as well, as you probably know, some of you who are my age, blind women were being channeled into being a rehabilitation counselor, a telephone operator, a typist in a typing pool. However, when I was being assessed by my career counselor at the Department of Rehab, I was channeled toward factory types of jobs, which I thought was very interesting. I never understood that. And I ended up getting a job in a lock factory. I was not tracked into the typical jobs for a blind woman. I'm not sure why. I won't say why. But I don't know if the guy thought I moved around a lot because I was Latina. I was like an immigrant worker, but I don't know. But anyway, I got a job, which was actually a good job. It was a minimum wage job, and I was raised a few times. But it was in a lock factory where I ran a punch press. I don't know. Again, this was pre-ADA, so I don't really know if anybody would give somebody a job like that these days because it was very dangerous and dirty. But it was a real good it was real insight into factory work. Anyway, I became, well, it has its, you know, it has its uses, I guess. I became very involved in the disability rights movement post-Muzzy Marcelino, his influence, and really have done all I can to sort of weave every, you know, the parts of me into my activism. And that's what made me very inspired to take this job at the Department of Labor, because I understand the value of good transition programs and internship programs that really do develop our soft skills. Many of us with disabilities, we often don't have age-appropriate experiences. So sometimes that impacts our ability to get work. And soft skills are necessary to make young folks like us competitive job candidates. I also lived in Mexico for 4 years in my early 20s, which gave me a real insight into the need to collaborate internationally and the need to, I don't know if Janet Lord is still in the audience, but Janet and I worked together on the United Nations Convention on the Rights and Dignity of People with Disabilities. And for me, that was very important. Because my work at the World Institute on Disability really was inspired by my international work, and I realized that, you know, folks from different cultures are coming into this country, and they have no idea about the disability rights movement. They have no concept of a social safety net, and it has, you know, it impacts our economy. It impacts everything in terms of how disabled folks are perceived. And so that's when I started working very specifically with the Latino community on Proyecto Vision, which was the first technical assistance to increase employment opportunities for Latinos, particularly with disabilities. So as I said, it's a thrill for me to be at ODEP. There's a lot going on. ODEP is rocking and rolling, as many of you know. And one of the first things I'd like to talk about is the federal executive order. And I think the president understands the intersection of all of these issues, issues that impact disability. And he gets the fact that folks with disabilities are leaving the government. And that's a whole other discussion. You know, our numbers have gone down in the last 10 years. So he established an executive order to increase the workforce by 100,000 people with disabilities in the next 5 years. Now, Clinton did that too, and it's all good. And the difference between this EO and the last one is that Obama is planning to keep track through OPM. I know that at the Department of Labor, we developed our work plan. And there's a lot of, you know, we have to measure how many people we hire. We have to make our hiring managers and our selective placement coordinators aware of where to recruit folks with disabilities. And I know that OPM is taking this very seriously too, with Christine Griffin as the deputy director. One thing that's very important, I know my time is ticking, is very soon the Department of Labor will come out with a notice of proposed rulemaking on Section 503. Since this is a law symposium, I'm assuming you all know that Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act is the part of the act that addresses the fact that federal contractors are required to hire people with disabilities. It's the affirmative action section of the Rehab Act when it relates to federal contractors. And frankly, Scarlett has neither been very affirmative or had much action in the last 20 years or however. I don't remember when it was last enacted. Hopefully, the reg that we're putting together, I think you'll be impressed, hopefully. It's a modernized version of 503. The NPRM, we expect it to come out sometime in the summer. We're hoping July. It'll be July or August, but please respond to it. We really need your response. And that's all I have to say about that. But I want you to, I'm serious, because if y'all don't respond, then you're stuck with what you get. I can't say much more, but please respond and know that federal contractors employ 23% of the American workforce. So if we pull together a good reg, you know, where there are checks and balances and there's solutions, not just naming the problem, but we tell them where you find people with qualified people with disabilities, you know, you know, we want it to be as close to the rag on race and gender as possible. But anyway, so there's that. We have also something called the Disability Employment Initiative. As you know, ODEP is collaborating with the Employment Training Administration. We've collaborated for 10 years on the program, Disability Program Navigators. That program was eliminated before I got to town, but we have replaced it with a joint effort called the Disability Employment Initiative. And basically, we awarded $22 million to 9 states. And the goal of the initiative is to expand the capacity of the one-stop career centers to serve customers with disabilities by building on ETA's Disability Program Navigator best practices and all their experience on that. I'm going to go quickly, and then you guys can hammer me with questions. So we're really happy about that. We're publishing a solicitation for grant activity, which should come out in the summer. I would say that, you know, if folks are interested in collaborating with their state workforce system to make this program a success, please do it. That is money that did not get cut from the budget. Another initiative that I'm very proud of and that I actually am just keeping very close track of is a new initiative called our Add Us In initiative. This kind of came out of my experience working with the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce when I was at the World Institute on Disability. And I thought that because I was Latina and they were Latina, that if I came to say, you guys really should hire people with disabilities because we have higher numbers of people with disabilities in our population, they would say, oh, that's a great idea. Wrong. I was so wrong. How long?
Couple minutes.
Okay, couple minutes. So the goal of the Add Us In initiative is to increase the capacity of minority-owned business, small businesses, to hire folks with disabilities. Now, it doesn't mean that Latino businesses can only hire Latinos. That is, I don't know where that rumor came from, but I want to just dismiss that right away. You know, the fact is that small business is the engine of the U.S. economy, and the data on minority business growth clearly shows that minority-owned and operated firms are a significant contributor to the long-term health of the U.S. economy. But basically what they're saying is we can't hire folks because we have 15 employees or less. We don't need to think about it. Well, we're kind of busting that myth. We have 4 consortia, Oklahoma, Kansas City, California, and Connecticut, who hopefully will give us some best practices to work with minority-owned businesses. I guess my time is up. I have been duly tapped, and there's a lot going on. Another area that we're really looking into is workplace flexibility. Also, the aging workforce, something very important to me. I know some of us aren't aging, but some of us are, and many of us are working longer. Our retirements just aren't what they used to be. We're going to have to work as older people, and what we do in the workforce is really going to impact how we accommodate folks who are aging who may not admit that they have a disability. It's kind of like my mom who says, you know, I'm blind, I can't see anything and I can't hear anything, but damn it, I'm not disabled. So, you know, these are some of the other issues that ODEP is working on. We're collaborating with the Department of Education on a number of issues. And I do expect some questions. I know I'll get questions on a certain topic, which I'll allow you to name. So thank you all very much.
Thank you. And thank you very much. One of the first cases I lost was a 503 case. So I'll be very interested in this regulation. And I have lots of questions about it, which I gather I'm not supposed to ask until after it's out. Our next speaker was nominated by the President to serve as Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the United States Department of Education, and the nomination was confirmed by the Senate May 1, 2009. Prior to joining the Department of Education, our speaker was Vice President at Education Trust and the founding Executive Director of Education Trust West. In the education arena, she has served as the liaison for the President with the Children's Defense Fund, as an Assistant Director of Policy and Research at the Broad Foundation, as Chief of Staff to the President of the Los Angeles United School District's Board of Directors, and she has taught at the University of Southern California and the University of California at Davis. In addition, she has worked as an attorney with the Los Angeles firms of Bird, Marella, Boxer, and Wolpert, and English, Munger, and Rice. University of California at Davis is a place that is accessible to the blind and print disabled, I'm pleased to be able to say. Please welcome Secretary Ruslan Ali.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Dr. Maurer, and thank you, Kathy. It's a pleasure to follow you. And thank you, Mr. Perry, for greeting us and being so helpful as we were invariably frenetic and rushing in, which happens far too often. I never realized how time could fly until I had the privilege of sitting on this perch. And this perch is one that both the President and Secretary have made all the more urgent and special, quite frankly, to me, when they both have said that this most important civil rights issue of our generation, that is transforming the way our schools work and ensuring that they work for all students, is something that all of us in the Office for Civil Rights tirelessly seek to accomplish every day in working with our colleagues in throughout the administration, including Kathy and others in labor, has been a real privilege as we think about a coordinated federal response, especially in these very, very tight budget times. Working together is the best way that we can support institutions around the country that are working to ensure that they are providing equal and fair opportunity to everyone. In my few minutes with you here today, and I hope that we'll have a further time during the questions and answers, I want to give you just a brief overview of some of the things that we've been doing in the Office for Civil Rights around the issues that I know you care deeply about. Last year, we received more complaints than ever before in the office's history, nearly 7,000. Over 60% of them, or about 60% of them, over 4,000, contained allegations of disability discrimination. About 3,400 were in allegations dealing only with Section 504 or Title II. So as you can tell, just by the nature of the complaint process in the work, a significant amount of our time and attention has been historically and will continue to be focused on ensuring that students with disabilities have equal access and are not discriminated against. In the first quarter of this year, we've received over 1,000 complaints containing disability discrimination allegations. That's about on track as we look at the data from last year. One of the very important tools for us is both collecting new data in the country so that we can better understand what happens to students under IDEA and Section 504 as they journey from kindergarten through the end of high school. You may have seen our revised, transformed, really, civil rights data collection, where for the first time we are disaggregating data from Section 504 and IDEA students. We are collecting data on access to college preparatory course sequences for all students, also disaggregated so we can better understand transition to college issues. We are collecting data about how much we're spending on the school site level for the first time, data about teachers, data about seclusion and restraint, and how many instances are happening and where. So I think you will be pleased with what you see beginning this summer, this spring and this summer, when we reveal those data for the first time, and we, along with you, will have access to a far more clear picture about what's happening to students with disabilities in our nation's schools. One of the other very important tools for us is the compliance review process. Those are proactive investigations that we launched. The Congress has charged us with sussing out systemic discrimination and working to alleviate it and remediate any concerns alongside partners in schools and states throughout the country. We launched last year, our fiscal year ends in September, and as of fiscal year 2010, we launched 8 disability-related compliance reviews on issues like identification of students for services, food allergies, transportation obligations, shortened instructional day, access to services, and resource comparability. Some of these are large districts, some are small. One is, in fact, a whole state, where in the state of Alabama, we are looking to see whether they are providing appropriate transportation services for students with disabilities, because it came to our attention that and as we began to do some preliminary study, it appeared that students in that state were actually receiving 12 fewer days of school a year because of when they needed to leave their schools because of transportation concerns. There were too few buses that picked up students earlier than they had to. In other words, you do that every day throughout the course of the year, and you realize that students are actually not getting what they are entitled to under the law in terms of instructional time. Those are the kinds of issues that we have launched proactively under this statute. In this fiscal year 2011, we will launch 12 disability-related compliance reviews. They will deal with issues, and in fact, we have launched 6 already by the end of March. We had launched 6. They are dealing with issues on harassment, access to schools of choice, for example, virtual charter schools that are enrolling significant numbers of students with disabilities, and we want to make sure, especially for students that are blind or have visual needs, that when they enroll in things like a virtual charter school program and all of the curricula and instruction is delivered virtually, that they are fully accessible for all students enrolled. We are looking at issues on access, thank you, on access to college and career-ready curricula. We know that the transition to college, and when we look at these data on both graduation rates and access to 2- and 4-year and good apprenticeship programs for students with disabilities is far too low. And in order to truly close that college-going and work-ready and career-ready gap. Students have to have access to the courses that they're going to need to succeed at the high school level and in throughout the pipeline from elementary to middle and beyond. So we are launching reviews around that, looking in particular at students under Section 504 and IDEA to ensure that they are getting the courses and supports and accommodations that they will need to succeed in them. We have launched proactive investigations into issues like segregation of students with disabilities and website accessibility. Now, I know that sitting up here telling you that we're launching investigations into website accessibility probably feels a little hypocritical. I will tell you that we know that, right? And we are clear on the requirements of 508 and at the highest levels of our agency. And I can say this for my colleagues and sister agencies. We are thinking deeply about how to and very quickly responding so that we too are in compliance with the requirements that we are asking school districts and colleges and universities to be compliant about. We are doing this in real time. Thank you. Hold us to account, right? Hold us to account. And I know so many of you already do. And thank you for that. No, thank you for that. We had the audacity. We. When I say we, most of the time I'm talking about the royal we. This one I'm talking about we, meaning me and my team had the audacity to put up the Kindle guidance that I know so many of you appreciated it and it wasn't accessible. Right? So we've learned a lot. And those are some of the things that I took for granted, right? I actually assumed that every time that we put up guidance in the Office for Civil Rights, that it would be fully accessible. So I can assure to you, and we got calls from you right away, and thank you, because by that night, within a few hours, we did have a fully accessible document up there. And we are working to ensure that every time that we get better and better and better. And I know I say fully in quotes on that one. But we are working to systematize these processes, and our undersecretary and our secretary and our deputy secretary and us assistant secretaries in the Department of Ed are ensuring that we are doing everything we can to meet the requirements. When it comes to that, the guidances that we have issued so far, that is our third tool. So the complaint resolution process and the compliance review process, those are about investigations to ensure that whatever the discrimination or cause concern is that leads to discrimination is sussed out and remediated. And our remedies and monitoring agreements, as my colleagues that have been in the office for many, many, many years tell me, our solutions and help and technical assistance to institutions is more robust than it's been in a very long time. We are working to ensure with local officials, as Arnie often says, this is not about gotcha. This is about supporting folks who need to and want to and will do the right thing. Our resolutions are more robust, ensuring that not just policies and procedures change, but that cultures of institutions change that give rise to the discriminatory conduct. And our monitoring agreements are more detailed and more robust as well. And we will ensure that promises made are promises kept. And that will include on-site monitoring as the case may be. So our third piece is the guidances. And as I hope you've seen, we've released two that I think you will be particularly interested in. One is the harassment guidance, bullying and harassment, where we made it clear that conduct that rises to the level of a hostile environment that adults knew or should have known about, that is peer-to-peer or adult-to-student, that makes it so students cannot learn because they do not feel safe, is a violation of Section 504 and will not be tolerated. And we have been working with institutions across the country on ways to comply with that guidance. Lastly, the electronic book reader guidance, where we partnered with our terrific colleagues at the Department of Justice. And I will say that the relationship between us and our colleagues in the Civil Rights Division and the Department of Justice in total has ensured that both our and some of our investigations where we have partnered and these guidances and our settlements where we have partnered promise the coordinated federal response that you are entitled to and that students are entitled to. And that renewed partnership, as many of our longstanding career colleagues say, has made the work all the more real and better and timely and effective. And we will continue those partnerships to ensure that kind of coordinated federal response. The electronic book reader was one of those kinds of partnerships. And there we settled where we had five, as you probably well know, we settled five cases against universities that were requiring the electronic book reader. And we made it clear that you could not do that unless they were fully accessible or you provided real and meaningful accommodations. And by fully accessible, we made it clear that that meant that all students had to be able to use the equipment and the emerging technology in an equally and effective, integrated manner. And when it comes to emerging technology, especially emerging technology, that standard that is not new, we did not create law, we did not overreach. We ensured clarity, and clarity in changing times, because unless things like the electronic book reader are not fully accessible, meaning everyone can access them in an equally and effective, integrated manner, then equal doesn't mean equal. If I cannot see or have trouble seeing, and I cannot find the book on the reader without somebody else finding it for me, that is not equally effective and integrated, right? So since then, we have seen some great change, both in the way that universities are thinking about emerging technology, and not just universities, school districts. Very shortly after we released the guidance, we were contacted by a school district in Florida that was about to use the Kindle and other electronic book readers and stopped for a moment to really think about the requirements for accommodations and realize that you couldn't start the accommodation process after you gave everybody else an electronic book reader. That it was something that on the front end, before you began using that instructional tool, you needed to ensure that other students had access to, and it was fully integrated and accessible. Coming soon, you will see guidance on the ADA amendments, where we want to make clear what the definition of disability is now, post the amendments. As you know, there's been a long series of decisions that many would say weakened it. And we are going to ensure what mitigating measures mean, and that responsibilities are still there despite glasses and despite medication. So we will be releasing that very soon. I have also learned to say on this perch that very soon does not mean what very soon used to mean before I had the privilege of joining the federal government. But we're working on it very, very fast. And on that one, I do feel like is sooner than most. We are also working on, okay. Thank you. I'm like you, Kathy. There is so much to say, right? On athletic guidance, where in response to the GAO report, we want to ensure that all students have access to equal access to extracurricular activities. And so we will be releasing guidance on that. We will continue our very aggressive technical assistance. I hope you have been able to participate in some of those that have happened here locally. in the region that partner with institutions and states around transitions to college and other needs of students under 504. I'm happy to talk a little bit more about some of them moving forward. We are looking closely at the emerging technology issues. We are resolving several long-standing cases. We've recently resolved in the summer what in part gave rise to Kindle, the Darden School of Business, where we made it clear that without the text-to-speech functionality, things were not accessible. We are currently monitoring that agreement where we are making sure that reasonable accommodation actually means reasonable accommodation. We have resolved cases in Montana dealing with accessibility and auxiliary aids and academic adjustments in Pennsylvania, in South Carolina around websites. You might also know about the Advisory Commission on Accessible Instructional Materials, where I sit as a member of AIM, and that commission is writing a report to Congress that will make strong recommendations on how to improve students' access to accessible instructional materials. So if you haven't had a chance to participate on the commission or come speak to commission members, I hope you will moving forward. We want to make sure it is not yet another white paper that sits on yet another shelf. We have resolved, as I mentioned, issues on transportation in places like Chicago, issues of harassment in places like in other places in Illinois, and on harassment in Virginia, where the kinds of harassment students with disabilities are subjected to in some of these investigations we are seeing are just shameful, and we need to shine a spotlight on what's happening so that people know that the movement that Kathy talked about is alive and well, and we need to keep going further because it has not yet been accomplished. So you will be able to see these resolutions on our website, because part of shining a spotlight and part of ensuring that what happens, what the good kinds of resolutions and the good things that are happening in one district have great impact across the nation means making those public too. So for the first time, you will be able to see and can see now these resolutions on our website, or they will be fully accessible to you if need be. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, if you folks would get to these microphones at the table there, we'll see about questions. I have, during the course of my life, either filed or caused to be filed a number of complaints with various departments of government, and I will admit it's lots more fun to go after the Internal Revenue Service. So if you just let them know.
We'll tell them.
Yeah. Are there questions for these secretaries?
Yes, sir.
Yes, go ahead, Dan.
Hi, this is Dan Goldstein, and I have a remark to Secretary Ali. Thank you for the work you've been doing. It has been making a difference. The letter that was sent out by you and Tom Perez has been an agent of change. At CSUN this year, Pearson Publishing was saying that letter has made all the publishers realize they have to be accessible. That said, there are a few other things we are thinking maybe you could do. There are teachers at the K-12 level and parents who are trying to tell the school administrations that adopting inaccessible educational technology is not acceptable, and they're putting their jobs at risk and they're putting their kids at risk of retaliation. And that same letter that you sent to all the college presidents needs to go to all the school districts in this country, because
it went.
Yes. Yes.
How about if you send us a copy?
That letter. I'm sorry, Daniel. Let me let you finish your question, and then let me explain what we're doing to ensure that everybody gets it.
Okay. Because what we've been hearing back from these parents and teachers is that the administrators are saying, "Well, that was college. That was colleges and universities." So there's at least some confusion there. And the other is, I seem to recall you had mentioned something about some FAQs or guidance that would follow the letter. I've heard rumors that that's being worked on, and it will be of tremendous utility, and the sooner that happens, the better.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, and thank you for all of your work and support and making us smarter, right? You know, the thing about the pushing is that, A, it's your right because we are a government of the people, but B, it really does make us smarter and think more deeply and ensure that what we do provide is as helpful as it can be to every stakeholder. So the guidance did apply to all schools. And we, though the resolutions were around the higher ed settlements, because we there we partnered with Justice and had not done the K-12 settlements yet. But you bring up a very good point, and if we need to do a reminder to school districts that these apply to them too, I'm happy to consider the right ways of doing that. Everywhere I go, I talk about it. So I'm hoping that confusion could get alleviated very soon. On very soon, the FAQ. Yes, it is so close. Really, 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 really so close. I promise. It's going through its very last rounds of clearance. But it's a good document that I think people will find particularly helpful in as much as it is supportive and helpful and shows some real how-to, as it is strong in reminding folks that we can't do this from Washington, but you have to do it. So, thank you. I'm sorry, and one last, on the risk of retaliation, we are right now doing guidance on retaliation under all of the statutes in the same way that harassment we did under all of the statutes, but made it clear what the unique circumstances of 504 were. We are doing the same on retaliation. On that is my normal very soon, so I can't, but it is a work in progress, and we are working on drafts. It's not just any longer an idea. Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes, thank you. I'm Joanne Simon. I want to thank you as well for all your work in this area. I have, and also the other guidance that you recently did that I thought was very, very helpful was on response to intervention, not being a way to delay evaluation of students with disabilities, and I think that was extremely helpful. But I wanted to go back to the point you made about restraint and seclusion and the reporting of those incidents. This is an issue that I've worked on a lot in New York, where the state regulations actually permit a fair amount of pretty awful stuff. And I'm not sure how accurate that reporting data is, and I'm wondering if you could address the mechanisms by which you're hoping to get this information so that we can ensure that we're actually getting a good reading on what's going on.
Yes.
Especially the timeout room prevalence.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for that question. In part because of your work and the great work of so many of your colleagues around the country, right when we came into office in the very early winter of 2009, the Congress and Congressman Miller and others were talking about this issue, shining a very bright spotlight on it. Many of you may recall, so you're talking probably late January, February, early March of 2009. And it was clear as we began understanding better both the complaint trends in 504 and what we didn't know about what we were seeing in schools, that getting a better handle on the instances had to be a huge priority. So two things happened. One, as you may recall, the secretary asked folks what their policies were as a sort of signal that we were paying attention to this, and that was a very big deal. And in the civil rights data collection, which is required by statute and has been since 1968, for the first time we are asking to report disaggregated as well. So overall instances and disaggregated, the instances of seclusion and restraint. Those data, will they be clean first go round? I'm hopeful. You can't obviously promise that. these kinds of reporting requirements are new and folks are very much struggling with the kinds of definitions, et cetera. That said, for the first time, we have a 100% reporting rate in part one of the collection. And I, for a long time, I refused to say 100%. I was like, it's like the high 90s, thinking that there had to be some school somewhere that didn't report, and I would never say 100, just like you never say never. And my colleagues, longtime career staff that have been doing this said, no, it is 100, and actually showed me, and it is 100, right? So that is pretty phenomenal. But that's in large part because of the kinds of technical assistance we're providing to answer questions about what we mean by physical restraint, right? So the definitions here are very particular, so that mechanical and physical, right? We're trying to get at real equity. We will, once we have these data that are coming in now, one of the other things we did was to fix some methodological problems with the survey. So many of you probably had used the civil rights data collection to look at issues like disability with students with disabilities and discipline rates, for example. But what we realized was that enrollment data and results data was actually collected at the same time, which meant that you couldn't be looking at the same cohort of kids. Enrollment data, demographics, et cetera, discipline data, how many times students were disciplined during the course year, right? You get one in the beginning of the year, you get one at the end of the year. If you're reporting it, who you're reporting it about, if you're only reporting it at one time. And what that meant, and additionally, what we realized is the national projections of the civil rights data collection had things like, we collected data on students with out disabilities, the presumption being that people could go to IDEA.org and collect data on students with disabilities. However, our national projections had all kids in the sample, which meant that our denominator was too big, right? And so we were probably underestimating the problem. Now, moving forward, I actually should have highlighted this during the opening remarks. All data on students with disabilities, you won't have to go to IDEA to get IDEA.org to get it and somehow map it with the civil rights data collection. It will all be in the civil rights data collection. And we have worked closely with our colleagues in OSERS and across the department to ensure that we were all using the same definitions and that these data were going to try and get to be as clean as possible. When we see places that, for example, have high or low or some other cause for concern instances of seclusion and restraint, that is a signal for us to go in and better understand. It is through getting these data for the first time in the country that we then will be able to audit them to see how clean they are, better understand how people are reporting them, and then moving forward be able to proactively launch investigations around it for the first time. We have not been able to do that. We've had to respond to complaints that we received, and as you probably know better than anyone, largely underreported, right? The complaints on this issue in particular are largely underreported because parents tend not to know, A, that there's a right not to, especially when it's explained as for your child's safety, right? So we will be able to proactively launch. You will be able, these data are totally public, so you will be able to see these data and target your own advocacy efforts and better understand the problem. So that is step one. That is not at all the completion of the process, but we get step one right, which we will have in a matter of weeks now. I think together we can really think about and lay out a strategy for moving forward.
Now, these accessibility requirements that you talked about earlier, they're applicable to online institutions, I trust, profit-making and nonprofit.
Any recipient of federal funds, whether they are profit-making or nonprofit.
Very well.
And on the profit-making side, as you may know or may have heard about, we have proposals on gainful employment, and those regulations should be out soon. There was, you may have seen, a rider in the budget bill that would have constrained and prohibited the secretary from using any monies on anything associated with gainful employment. That rider did not make it through the budget.
Other questions?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Secretaries, for your presentations. Kathy, it's Janet. Yes, I am here. And you've done a tremendous amount to support the employment of persons with disabilities, not only here, but also abroad. And my concern as an international development practitioner is the employment of persons with disabilities in our foreign assistance programs that are now being implemented not only by USAID, the State Department, and DOD, but name your agency. And so my question to you is, A, you know, what can your office do to facilitate that process? And also, what is your take on the application of 503 in respect of federal contractors and our international development programs?
Good question. Well, I'm hoping that you will take a good look at the NPRM and respond. I think that, I was on the National Council on Disability and worked with you very closely on a paper that said that we believe that 503 is applicable to federal contractors abroad. I'm hoping that when this NPRM comes out, you'll see that I think we have a good reg, and I think certain parts of it need to be strengthened. In terms of employment, in international development or foreign service or foreign aid, I think we have a long way to go. I think the administration, you know, made some good choices in putting folks with disabilities in USAID and at the State Department. And I know that there's been a few more hires within the State Department for folks in the Foreign Service, but we're just completely unrepresented. I mean, we have a there was a what was the guy's name, the blind guy that I know he was a member of the NFB, Rami Rabi, that did all the trailblazing, and I know that the State Department has hired a few more Foreign Service people in the last year, but I think we have a long way to go. In terms of what labor can do, we have an international office that we work with. It's primarily around kind of state-to-state kind of formal agreements, like, you know, our work, we've done some work with the EU about recruiting policies, about, you know, what is the concept of reasonable accommodations. But it hasn't been as robust as it should be, frankly.
Other questions?
Thank you. I have my name is Larry Berger. I have a question for Secretary Ali, and it has to do with the question of state funding for special education, which is frequently, you know, the three most important things affecting individual special education cases. And I say that both from a perspective as being a former school board member and also from the perspective of now being involved in some special ed litigation. One of the things the department does, and I don't know to what extent OCR is involved in this, is it considers requests from individual states for waivers of the maintenance of effort requirement. And the department recently granted such a waiver to New Jersey, which is my state. I guess there are various safeguards there. The waivers come together with a statement that, of course, the state is still required under IDEA to provide for a free and appropriate public education and so forth. But as a practical matter, looking at the next year and looking at beyond, in a state where such a waiver has been granted, what can special education advocates do to make sure that that really happens?
So two things. One, it is something that I've been very tangentially involved in, sort of in talking with my colleagues around the secretary's strategy or policy or other conversations at that level. This is something that, though, my colleague Alex Posny
My colleague, Carmel Martin, who, so Alexa is the Assistant Secretary for OSERS and our Office of Special Ed. Carmel Martin is our Assistant Secretary for Policy and Budget, that they have been steeply involved in. So I don't want to speak with any real expertise on this. We could definitely get back to you with more specific answers. That said, what I would have said is what you said, and that is that we were very clear to make it that in any waiver for MOE or others, that the requirements of IDEA and FAPE were not just your check-the-box assurance, but would really be adhered to and tried to bolster the language that pushed them to do that, right? But clearly, with this fiscal crisis that's not getting any better, without the possibility, it looks like, that we will have another $100 billion investment into schools the way we did with the president and the then bipartisan Congress in 2009, it is going to get tougher than ever before. That means that, and I think this is where your instinct is, that means that the work of advocates and folks in the field to use those assurances and those commitments and those promises as real obligations that if not followed through on, the strategy that you would employ when folks don't follow through on other obligations would apply there too, right? So we continue to push us to make sure that we hold folks to account as well. These assurances are preconditions of federal funds, right? And if we don't make sure that they are really preconditions, then it just becomes lots of rhetoric and business as usual. So I wish I had a better answer for you, but I will say this, waivers are not, I certainly, again, I'm not steeped in the process, but I know my colleagues, and they are not granted without deep deliberation and consideration of all of the factors surrounding it. And they are not granted lightly.
Other questions?
Yes. Hi, I'm from LA. My name's Paula Perlman from the Disability Rights Legal Center. So, Kathy, I have actually things for both of you, but Kathy, I am also the president of the Employment Roundtable of Southern California. We work with the DFEH, and there are several federal contractors on the Employment Roundtable and come to our trainings, and they are really looking for guidance on how and what they can do and what's allowed to recruit people with disabilities. Can they, besides job fairs, like people want to help people fill out applications, they want to do more and they don't know what they're allowed to do. So to the extent that you can provide guidance, and maybe that's with Pat Hsu, but they really need help.
Well, Pat Hsu is the enforcer, and ODEP is, you know, we can be kind of the nice guy that helps people out. Actually, Pat has been amazing. She's an amazing collaborator, and she really gets this issue, and she's been, she's just been a super. It's been a pleasure to work with her on developing this reg. Maybe this is something we should take offline, because I'd be happy to help guide you to places and to tell you what we're doing. Through our EARN, our technical assistance program, it's through Cornell, we have gathered information from every state about recruiting. Now, you talked about when you said something about filling out applications.
They want to assist people with, you know, the application process.
Hopefully, our reg will be strong enough that people will be able to apply online themselves. That's kind of the goal here. I mean, you know, we have to have online application processes accessible. In my view, as somebody who is a JAWS user, and so We should talk about that.
Okay.
Because the goal really of this modernized reg is to have online application processes accessible.
Great. So can I ask Secretary Ali, can
Please
I just
do.
To ask a couple, well, here's some of our issues from California, funding. But besides that, we've sued the state for not looking at transition planning for students with disabilities, transitioning from, you know, high school to post-secondary education. They have done nothing in that area, and so they did create a new form, and you can check a box. It's very nice, but it's meaningless. It's absolutely meaningless, and these kids deserve better. So the fact, any investigation or guidance on that is really needed. Also, we do a lot of litigation about special ed and mental health services and other related services in custodial settings. So we've sued LA County Probation, San Bernardino Probation, lots of other investigations, including the county jail. So both for kids in custody to ensure that they receive special ed and related services. And then this 18 to 22-year-old group of students who end up in state prison and don't have any services, or end up in county jails and don't have any services that they're entitled to. We have like two cases on that right now. And then the mental health, the AB 3632, we have sort of a better system. We had a very good system in California for mental health services, and we're really concerned that they'll just disappear with the funding that was just eliminated for those services.
Yeah, up until 2 years ago, I lived in California. So I get it, and I get it. So on the just a note on funding, it was also a previous question as well. One of the things, of course, through 504 and FAPE and requirements for accommodations, et cetera, we will vigorously enforce, and comparability of resources, which we have also launched investigations on comparability of resources. Those things are hugely important as we try and get funding equity with the money that is supposed to be distributed today, the way it's distributed today. There is a larger question, though, and that is the systems of state and local finance for schools, and the appropriate role of the federal government in helping states achieve equity. For very similar reasons as you've just described many times, and in fact there are over 40 state litigations that have tested whether the systems of funding are constitutional, and many, many have said no, but punted it to the state legislature, as in the case of what you're describing in California, to do something about it. And then few have failed to. So the secretary called for and announced an Equity and Excellence Commission that commenced on February 22nd. Its purpose is to make recommendations on systems of state and local finance, and you can bet, given the caliber of these commissioners and their focus on equity, that issues of funding or under IDEA and others are some of the topics that will be undoubtedly addressed. So stay tuned for that. We will also be issuing on mental health. I can't speak to what California will do, but we are in our pipeline. We are planning to issue guidance on issues of mental health for universities and their requirements under the civil rights laws for all students.
Madam Secretary Ali, your help has been very good, and I appreciate it. We think there's a right to read. And we hope you take this into consideration when you're developing regulations, thinking about directives, helping with case studies and the like. We think that the right to read is fundamental. We think that the right to information is fundamental. And we've noticed that sometimes the school districts have said that Braille is a very nice thing if you can get it worked in. And the if you can get it worked in means except we're not going to. So we urge you to think of that. I mentioned to Secretary Martinez earlier that we were going to put in a 14C bill. And I said she'd get a question. I noticed she hasn't had one, so I'm going to take care of that. She said to me that she is a federal employee, and she said she's a good friend of mine. And she said that 14C is a thing that the government administers. And I was satisfied with that answer. And I was satisfied because I came away from that answer thinking to myself that the department might not have a position to support the legislation, but it would probably not have a position to oppose the legislation. And I think that'll suit me. If either of you want to comment on either of those things, now would be the time.
Well, I'll comment. At ODEP, we are developing a toolkit, which should be out in the summer, that is pulling together all the, it's actually quite a bit of information about how people have been transitioned from segregated employment to integrated employment. And it's both for parents, it's for community rehab providers who sometimes can say, you know, this is an impossible task. Now we understand that, that this is a very old system. It's an antiquated system. It was developed in the 30s. When people like myself would be making brooms or caning chairs. We understand that we have evidence at ODEP that people with significant disabilities can work, and we are pulling together evidence of best practices where people with very significant disabilities who have otherwise been deemed not employable or can only make a subminimum wage are thriving in integrated employment, making minimum wage or better.
And Secretary Martinez said that if I looked in the right places, I could find evidence of all of this, and she knows about it and might help me find it, which I thought was very nice.
Well, it's out there. It just hasn't been pulled together in one spot. So our goal is to have, to be the spot where people can find, I mean, believe me, you know, there's issues. There's issues that people like Alan Bergman will talk about who tried to do it. Alan is somebody from Chicago who ran a community rehab facility, tried to turn it into an integrated employment facility paying minimum wage or better, and I think it's important to see what the barriers are to people that have tried it, and you know how we could address those is another discussion, but the fact that there is evidence and there are examples of people who have addressed the barriers in one way or another is important to know. And to me, it's very important that evidence and information is pulled together so people don't have to trot all over half of Georgia to find it. Sorry, Neil.
On Braille, I'm actually going to help one of my one of the smartest colleagues in the Office for Civil Rights, Howie. I'm going to ask your help in answering that question. When you come, I'm going to put you on the spot. You guys know way more than me.
You know way more than me about way more. So, I mean, generally, and I really will, I think Howie can answer it much more better than I, but generally, where we are not going to stipulate how the accommodations are done. We're going to stipulate a standard for what that means and what fully accessible, and we are going to check and really benchmark what the institution is doing against those standards. But can you speak specifically about Braille, Howie? Howie's our chief, one of the chiefs at in our metro regional office.
And DOJ may be able to help me with this as well. The new
DOJ. I saw Mazin, but I was going to punt it to him, but I think he left.
Yeah, because he knew you were going to raise the question. And the new Title II regulations talk about effective communication. And do say, and OCR has said this in the past as well, that the district, the school has to give up, in talking about effective communication, you give a preference to the mode that the individual wants. But the reg only says a preference. Mm-hmm. It's not an absolute right. And so we are operating within that constraint. But it's certainly something that we have pushed in the appropriate cases, both in terms of Braille and the sign language where somebody wants ASL versus signed English or vice versa. And we have tried to use what leverage we could to make sure that the school or the college does provide the method of communication that the individual prefers.
Thank you.
In the Baltimore Public School District of recent time, there were 133 students denominated as blind. Six of them were using Braille.
And I think that, I mean, Howie underscores the issue, right? It is we can ensure that the statutes and the standards are adhered to. We can't stipulate how, nor can we stipulate when things say a preference that it's a must, in as much, though, as we use language like should, right? So it is something that really would require congressional action to make it a must. That is true for education as a right. As many of you know, it's not embedded in our Constitution. So if we don't get education as a right, the right to read. Okay.
Secretary Ali, Secretary Martinez, it's an honor to have you at our Jacobus Ten Broeck Disability Law Symposium. We appreciate all the good things you've said. We look forward to working with you in time to come. As we come to the end, I would say that this has been a most successful disability law symposium. I want to thank the American Association of People with Disabilities. I want to also thank our sponsors, Brown, Goldstein, and Levy, Furliger Wealth Management, the Maryland Department of Disabilities, Rosen, Bien, and Galvin, Thomson Reuters, the American Bar Association Commission on Mental and Physical Disabilities, and the American Bar Association Section on Labor and Employment Law. I look forward to the next one. I myself think that I learned a good bit, and I shall be stimulated to pursue disability work in the next year. Thank you all for coming.